tears. Anyway, welcome back to Lunch Break. It's 1:05, and with me is Matt Adamson, and we're going to be talking about burnout, stress. We've got a list, and we won't get through it today. We've got about another six sessions, I think. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you. All light and happy topics.
Right. Give us a little bit about your background.
Well, as we were sharing off air, I'm a country bumpkin at heart. I was born and raised in the Lake District. But professionally, I have spent my career in the world of careers, basically. Recruitment, HR, and that led me, having started off in the Midlands and then moved to London, it led me to Hong Kong for 15 years, which was a wonderful time. And for the last 9 years that I was there, I ended up working for the Swiss bank, UBS. And I worked in their HR function. And I was responsible for a few areas within that. I was the head of internal mobility for Asia Pacific for them. So working with the bank's top talent and helping them identify their progression route, how they wanted to develop their career, what they would need to do that in terms of connections and training and this sort of stuff, and fundamentally trying to make sure that they did that in UBS rather than crossing the street to a competitor. But also I was responsible for all the hiring in the bank in APAC that wasn't revenue generating, as well as all the graduates that we hired. So I had quite a lot on, and that led, unfortunately, to 2022, me burning out in quite spectacular fashion. And it took me a good 2 years to get back on my feet after that and even think about working again. But when I did, I took the services of a career coach to sort of help myself process my thinking and work out what I wanted to do. And I ended up sitting across from the guy and saying, I want to do what you do.
Let's go back to Hong Kong.
Yes.
And everything really getting on top of you.
Hmm.
Leading to burnout. Was it depression as well?
The depression didn't come in the initial phase. The initial phase was around anxiety and the burnout. But the problem then that I had was, particularly Hong Kong, but I think everywhere really, there's a lot of status attached to your job. It's the first question that we often ask each other. And what do you do? I would say that in Hong Kong, it's maybe a little bit more loaded than it is here, because there's connotations about the size of your flat and the newest car that you've got and the fanciest holiday and stuff. But when I quit due to ill health, that then effectively removed my identity in that sense, which was, I'll be honest, shaky in the first place, which was part of the reason for my burnout. But that sort of notion of who was I? I'm no longer an executive director at UBS, which was a nice, proud thing to say. So that's then when the sort of the depression followed, because I sort of lost my way really for a bit. And it took me a while to get out of that particular hole.
So you had to leave UBS, leave Hong Kong?
Well, I didn't leave Hong Kong for another 18 months. Early mid 2022, and we escaped very briefly in late spring, summer 22, and came back here, because at that point, when the rest of the world was going, "Ooh, Omicron variant seems to be less dangerous, don't seem to be able to stop it, so let it go," Hong Kong went, "No, double down," and putting everybody into quarantine facilities. And of course, because of how virulent it was, their quarantine facilities filled up within a matter of a week or so. And then it became questions of, we haven't got space for the child and the parent. The parent doesn't have COVID. The child does, so the child goes in. The parent doesn't. Which was kind of a bit of a hard no for us.
Well, yes, because you don't want to be separated from the child.
No, I had two
child
young.
Child doesn't want to be separated.
No, two young children, and I can't imagine anything worse. There were horror stories at that time of young babies being separated from mothers and stuff, and so we're like, "No, got to get out." But late summer, things started to make a turn for the better in Hong Kong, so we went back, and we then did another year in Hong Kong, during which time I wasn't working. I was still very much in recovery mode before we made a family decision to move back to the UK.
Was there much support from UBS?
No.
That seems to be a general answer, that employers want to wash their hands of you as quickly as possible. Yeah. So did COVID itself add to the pressure?
I'm sure it did. COVID in Hong Kong was not a nice place to be. There was very strict rules, as there were in a lot of places, but it seemed to go on and on. I mean, my children weren't in school really for two whole years. They just completely shut the schools. It was online teaching, and you were then, it's crazy, you weren't allowed out in groups of bigger than two. So we would leave our houses of four and have to separate because you weren't allowed to walk the streets in bigger than groups of two. And I would be doing exercise and you had to keep your masks on to exercise. So it's like 35 degrees heat, 90% humidity, and you're wearing a mask. So all of that, I'm sure, contributed.
On its own, it doesn't sound much, but with everything else that going on, it just carries on heaping on the pile.
And that's the thing with burnout, really. It's not a single event. It's not a single thing. It tends to be the build-up and build-up of a gradual selection of stresses, and then some minor thing will tip the scale. And, yeah, in my case, my wife entered our son's bedroom. I was working on his little desk underneath his bunk bed. And she came in and found me on the floor sobbing. And I don't know what the little thing was that triggered me on that particular day. It'll have been something I dealt with a million times before, but yeah, I just didn't have the bandwidth anymore to deal with it.
And sort of breaking down in tears is not uncommon with burnout, but it's unexpected. What's caused this?
And in all honesty, when I left, I initially blamed UBS. I already had three jobs, some of which I'd inherited because they'd let people go and not replaced and just gone, well, you can do that as well. And then the Singapore government got very jumpy about the sort of 3-4 years post-graduate population. There were still in COVID, there were still lots of graduate schemes running, but it was that 2 or 3 years post-graduation where there was just no market, and they got very, very concerned, and so basically went to all the employers in Singapore, the big ones anyway, and said, if we give you money explicitly for creating schemes to employ this cohort, will you take it? And lots of organizations looked at all the audit trails and strings attached to justify this money and went, no thanks. UBS went, free money? Oh, yeah. And so then some muggins was tasked with delivering that on top of the other jobs that I was doing. And then the Hong Kong government went, ooh, Singapore are doing that. We better do that. So same again. So I blamed UBS initially for all of it. But then, yes, as I unpicked it all and tried to get my head around what on earth had happened, and that involves therapy and medication, but also just speaking to other people who I identified as having burnt out or burning out or whatever, and just trying to get my head around it all, I realized that actually, yes, they could have done better. There were things that they could have done differently, but there was an awful lot of agency on my side and choice that I had that I didn't see and therefore didn't take. For example, the word no wasn't in my vocabulary. Or yes, I can take that on for you, but what am I going to deprioritize? You know, that kind of conversation never happened, which is on me, not them. It was a bit of a combination of factors, really. And that's what I always say, really, these days, is that work is often the trigger for a burnout, but the cause is often an individual's reaction to that trigger and what lies behind that individual reaction. Because even in the most toxic of workplaces, right next to somebody burning out can be somebody thriving. And it doesn't make one person weaker or stronger. It's just a combination of different factors at that particular moment.
We're going to stop in a second. I just want to say, when you say you've got somebody who's thriving on one side and somebody's burning out on the other, do you notice the chap burning out?
The chap burning out won't notice. He'll think he's tired and a bit fed up with work and a bit disconnected. So it does take somebody external often to spot it. I didn't spot it in myself, and that's the same when I speak to others, but there are signs.
Right. Well, we'll come on to that. We've got Rory popping in to give us Tuesday's events guide. You're listening to Lunch Break with me, John Butt, here on West Kent Radio. With me is Matt Adamson, and we've been talking about burnout and some of the causes. But we're looking now at what it looks and feels like to burn out. Now we're getting personal, aren't we?
Yeah, now it's yes. What it looks and feels like. Well, I mean, I would caveat it by saying that my burnout is not necessarily the next person's burnout, and it's not one prescribed thing that's burnout. But I can certainly say for me, it was a complete and utter exhaustion. I remember I'd been hanging on through the back end of 2021. I knew I was tired, and I'd sort of been hanging on and going, I've booked 2 weeks off at Christmas. That'll all be okay then. I'll have that 2 weeks off and all will be good. And actually my first crash was 4th of Jan, first day back after the new year, when my body and my mind very quickly realised that 2 weeks off hadn't sorted it. So that was when my wife found me in tears. I was signed off work for a month and, of course, went back after 1 week because I had the narrative playing of, my team can't deal without me. I don't want them to be experiencing the pressures I've been feeling, so I need to support and cover them. But then, yeah, that was not a long-term solution, and it happened again about 3 months later, which is when I then quit. And then that exhaustion really kicked in. I there were days I couldn't, it sounds so strange to say it now, but there were days I couldn't get out of bed. I was so tired to my very core that I just could not get out of bed. Just not fun. And then I sort of got to the point where the only thing really getting me out of bed, and this is sort of when we got a little bit later into 22, when, as I noted before, the depression had kicked in as well, was literally taking my daughter to and from nursery was the only thing that I was like, right, I've got to get up to do that. And that was a high point in the day. But yeah, that exhaustion and lack of emotional bandwidth to deal with anything. I was not a nice person to be around. Argumentative, snappy, short.
Did you realise that at the time?
No, I blamed it on other people. Yeah. My wife in particular, you're provoking an argument here, would be my view at the time. and this isn't helpful. Later reflection revealed that actually I was flying off the handle at the smallest thing. And, you know, those are some of the signs. I always laugh because my wife would take a look at my end of year appraisals at work that would say, Matt is this incredibly calm person, totally unflappable, nothing fazes him. And she would look at it and go, who's that guy and why doesn't he come home?
Yes.
Because as soon as I would get home, the mask would fall and all of the stress that I'd been holding tightly would just come out. Blah. And yeah, I wasn't a particularly good husband, wasn't a particularly good dad. I would, you know, kids do silly things. Of course they do. But I would then tear a strip off them for doing so, shouting at them. And yeah, so do carry guilt these days still for that. But
kids can be very forgiving. Would you?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not sure about wives, but
they do tend to be. And to be honest, one of them really got me. One of them really got me because my son, when this happened, was 9, 10. My daughter was about 5. So I was like, There's no conversation to be had with my daughter here. She's just too young. But I'm going to have a little bit of a conversation with my son. And when I told him that Dad was not well and Dad needed to take some time out, his first reaction was, who's going to pay for the holiday? Because that's how my wife and I had always justified heading off out the door to work. Why do you have to go out to work? Yeah. Well, you like the nice flat that we live in, you like the nice holidays that we go on. So this was his immediate thought when Daddy's not working was, who's paying for the holiday then? And I said, it's okay, we're okay, we'll manage that, it's all right. Fast forward 3 months and he comes back to me and says, Dad, are you going back to work soon? And I said, no, Ed, Dad's really not in a good place. Dad's not well. He's still struggling with a lot of this stuff. I said, is it the holiday? Because we'll sort it. It'll be okay. And he turned and looked at me and went, no. You're just around a lot more and I like it.
Well, that
got me there.
Well, that was being appreciated, wasn't it? That was an affirmation, even though you were in hell. That's good.
And that's where I've done a bit of a reframing of things over the last few years. I used to say I'd lost 2 years of my life. Now I say I lost 2 years of my career because I most definitely got a lot more time with my children than I would have. I used to fly off to India and China every month and be away all week, and then I'd get back on the red eye flight and so be exhausted. So I would be there, but I wouldn't be there, if you know what I mean. I've got distinct memories of waking up in the soft play and realizing that my children had run off somewhere. Could I have fallen asleep? So that kind of affirmation was a part of me getting back on my feet and seeing that I had value outside of work.
Right, the other side of travel, we're going to come back and we'll talk about resilience, how that we can build that into our systems.
Yes.
We're now going on to the next stage about resilience. So, Matt, you can talk about resilience without hesitation, deviation.
I often trip up at this point. No. I mean, it's two parts to it. One is that companies do contact me and say, how do we build resilience into our workforce? And I go back to them and say, I'm not sure you're asking the right question. Why do they need more resilience? What's going on? What's the behaviours and the expectation and everything like that? But as I said at the start, there is an individual part to it, and there's self-determination here and the ability to have choice and agency, which you don't necessarily recognize, but I would say everybody needs to do it. And none of it really is rocket science. It's all things that we know tied into self-care, a lot of it really. It's very interesting. There's a lot of data now that supports a direct link between doing things that have meaning and value for you and building resilience and being more resilient. I sometimes work with some of my clients to create or co-create, because they're their answers, their happiness list. I actually ask them to literally list down a list of things that they do that when they do them spark joy, provoke a smile, bring enjoyment to them. And then ask them to say, look at it and go, when did you last do those things? And unfortunately, quite often it's, I did that last year, did that a couple of months ago. And it's like, okay, right, can we build a plan to make sure that these things become more habitual? Because it is those things that will build resilience. It's not about, mentally toughening yourself through some sort of gymnastics that you need to do. It's not about the fact that you're weak and therefore you need to build resilience. It's that, whatever is going on in your mind, particularly in the likes of people pleasers, as we've mentioned, and often high performers who are the ones that are most at risk of burnout, it's whatever's going on in their mind needs intercepting. And being intentional about your self-care and enjoyment is one of the very best things you can do. It's interesting. The world of professional sports, rest is considered a key component of optimal performance. You know, the night before breaking a world record, Usain Bolt's not doing the hardest training session of his life. He was eating fried chicken. I'm not sure how good that is, but he certainly was resting and recuperating. And yet when it comes to the world of work, we just seem to have this very binary view of do more, get more done. And it's like, well, no. Again, data supports the fact that actually beyond a 40-hour working week, which is sort of considered the optimal for productivity, you can, of course, do sprints. You know, accountants have to sprint every month, every month at month end. And the notion of them completing month end in a 40-hour week, they'd probably laugh at me. The problem comes when you normalize that sprint. And if you normalize that sprint for any more than a couple of weeks, really, you can go into a net deficit on productivity. So this very notion that we tell ourselves of work longer, do more, get more done, is a fallacy.
So part of resilience is actually having to say it's time to stop.
Yeah, absolutely. It's putting those boundaries in place that is very difficult to do, particularly if you've built your reputation in an organization around always being available. To suddenly go, no, I'm putting some boundaries in, can really shake things up a little and get people, what? You always used to answer my emails at 11 o'clock at night. Why are you not now?
I think that's what's added to the stress, is emails and texts that outside of office hours, in inverted commas.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? This is the big conundrum with regards to work-life balance and flexibility, is the fact that we can now all very easily work from home can be a big positive. Enables us to pick up and drop off kids from school and engagements more easily, gives us more autonomy over our day, gives us more of our day because we don't have to travel for an hour each way, we're there. But the downside of that is that work has now invaded the home. The laptop's in the corner, the emails are constantly pinging, and unless you're very intentional about those boundaries, it can just be invasive.
One of my former employers said that the day has 24 hours in it. You work 8 hours, you sleep 8 hours, and the other 8 hours are for you. And that was good advice as a...
Very good advice.
But then, all we had the telephone. If we weren't in the office, we couldn't.
Yes.
The telephone. But these days, you know, it's finding where to have the cut-off. Now, I get quite strict that... I used to have Fridays a day off, you know, one day off in seven. So, and I would not answer emails on a Friday. Then I got told off, everybody else has 2 days off for the weekend. If you're not doing anything on the Sunday, if you're not being demanded anything on Sunday, have Friday and Saturday off. And then it was saying, well, I won't answer emails Friday or Saturday either. And actually, shutting down the computer at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night is good. I just wish that other people would turn their phones off, but we won't go into that. We'll go to a sports update. She might be listening. You're listening to Lunch Break here on West Kent Radio. With me is Matt Adamson. We've been talking about burnout, recognising it, what we do about it. And we can, once we've recognised it, and other people have recognised it first, we know what it feels like. We've got to start picking ourselves up against that. It's building resilience, making time for ourselves, putting boundaries in, was the expression you used. Mm-hmm. There comes a time when we need to go out to work to bring in income.
Yes.
So how do we start building a sustainably successful career? And don't say it's easy.
It isn't. On a personal note, I'm still working it out, really, because I've made certain decisions about what my career is now, and getting a business going from scratch is, you know, it's hard work, but it's coming. So there's a fantastic book that I love by a gentleman called Sahil Bloom, which is called The Five Types of Wealth. And he argues within it, and I fully agree with him, that there are five types of wealth. And of course, the first of those is financial wealth. There is a lot of hurt and pain and everything in the world because people don't have enough of that. So of course, you've got to focus in on that. But there is also four other types of wealth. He defines them as physical health wealth, mental health wealth, the wealth of time, and the wealth of community. Because at the end of the day, you can have all the money in the world, but if you're not well enough to enjoy it, or you don't have the time or the people to enjoy it with, frankly, what's the point? So these are the things that you need to be having a look at. Of course, we have to look at financial wealth. And within that, probably means you need to develop your career. You know, we have increasing financial demands as we move through life. And there's nothing wrong with ambition. In fact, I certainly feel that ambition is a positive thing when harnessed in the right way. It provides stretch to what we do. If we remain forever in our comfort zone, we don't learn, we don't challenge ourselves. So there has to be an element of that. But it's about recognizing that these other types of wealth, which are not so measurable or quantifiable, that we're meeting those as well. That's, I guess, at the essence of building that sustainable career. And the starting point for a lot of that is self-awareness. Self-awareness is critical. I never had it. and it's critical to building a sustainable career. I've developed a little model that I go through with my clients, which looks at the sources of burnout, but of course, obviously, inversely, the route away from burnout, as being, I call it my three buckets of burnout. And in the three buckets, they are, number one, the fundamentals of self-care, which we've spoken about, rest, diet, exercise, all of the good stuff that we know about but can find difficult to be consistent with. The second one is connection to values and purpose. Now, it's a double-edged sword, this one, because coming from a corporate background myself, I always felt that it was a disconnection from the values and purpose of the organization. I certainly felt that by the time I left UBS, I was getting quite cynical about the direction that we were going and not happy with quite a lot of the management decision making. And so that disconnection was a problem. Then I started talking to small business owners and realized that the inverse was true as well, that when you're too connected into the values and purpose of the organization, and when it contains your very value and being, it's my name over the door, then that's equally problematic. So it's around ensuring a healthy balance in that bucket. And then the third requires, unfortunately, some deep reflection work, because it's about that thing that all coaches love to talk about, which is limiting beliefs. Now, for me personally, when I dug down and dug down and dug down as to what lay behind my decision making and my inability to put boundaries in, it was unfortunately a fundamental belief at the bottom that I wasn't good enough. Here was I, a kid from the Lake District, from a state school and a not particularly rich family. What was I doing in a boardroom in Hong Kong? I fundamentally didn't feel I belonged there. And so I would do everything that I could to get the validation that I myself wasn't able to give myself. So investigating that, what lies behind my thinking and my actions, and exploring it is also key to making things sustainable.
I think that's a good place to stop, because I think we're touching on imposter syndrome, which is going to be where we start next time when you join me again on November the 10th. So thank you, Matt. We'll look forward to seeing you again.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And